It is Tuesday, November 18, 2025, and I'm going to call the City of Iowa City work session to order. I want to make sure that Councilor Wyline, that you can hear us and we can hear you. Will you say hello, please?
Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you. Welcome.
Welcome.
All right. We're going to move on to item number one, which is the University of Iowa Student Government Updates. Welcome, welcome.
Hello. So sorry we missed last session. I knew council was on election day, and for some reason that didn't compute that we probably wouldn't be having normal scheduled council. Anyway, we just have a few announcements tonight. First things first is we mentioned the multicultural food drive a couple weeks ago. A new update for that will be happening during the spring semester, so we can have more time to plan everything out. We're currently reaching out to various establishments downtown, the senior center, places like that, to host the donation bins. We've also got the coat check program that I've talked about. Right now, we're currently still looking for like a home for it downtown. That's all the update I have on that.
Yeah. Oh. I don't have any updates.
I said her announcement. I'm so sorry.
All right. Well, welcome. I mean, good luck next week because you all are going to be off, right? Yes. All right. We're going to move on to item number two, which is clarification of agenda items. Hearing nothing from the agenda, we'll move on to information packets, item number three, starting with November 6th. Moving on to November 13th, and we have two items that we do need to discuss. One is a memo from the city manager, and this is relating to the sister city appointment. So wondering if there is a desire for council to kind of just select someone now to be that representative between now and the end of the year, and then when we do our January, is it the second organizational meeting?
The sixth, maybe.
The sixth. When we do a January 6th, we'll be able to select someone then officially.
And what are the requirements and what is the scope?
I think so if we go back to the resolution, essentially the council appointment is something that this council had in the resolution where we said we want someone on that board of directors. And so I guess if you're asking, which is a fair question, what is the expectations of the sitting councilor? I think it's to make sure that I won't even say the will of the council is being voiced, but kind of just making sure that in those meetings they're present, someone is present, can recite, remind what our resolutions are. I think be a part of the conversation from, you know, this elected bodies.
And I think so you're going to be following everything that their board of directors rules and bylaws, so okay.
I will say that Mayor Pro Tem brought this to the council in 2019. And so
I was just gonna say that I think she would be wonderful if you would want to do it.
I really want to do it, but I don't want to say like I want to do it without like
I think you would be amazing.
Thank you. All right. Thank you for the trust.
All right. So
sounds great to me as well.
Thank you.
So we're going to appoint Mayor Pro Tem Sala as our representative again in January. We will have an official vote.
Sure.
But if something happens between now and then.
Yes.
Have fun. All right. And then we're going to go on to IP6, which is a memo from the city clerk. And this is the proposed schedule. Really have to kind of nail down a lot of the budget season, so.
I have a strong preference for the Saturday date, and I know that that's
January the 31st?
January the 31st. Mondays would be very difficult for me. I'm not sure if that works for everyone else, though.
Let me look. I think it'll work.
Saturdays also work well for me.
Yeah, I'm okay on the 31st. I can do.
The 31st?
January 31st, yeah. Saturday.
The January.
Yeah, January.
Yeah, January 31st. Okay.
Not
yes.
December.
Yes.
Not December.
Yes, yeah. I'm not going to be here in December, so.
Making it sour cream?
It's just the mayor's innovation conference is the 31st.
Yeah, and...
Isn't the mayor's? Isn't your...
Yeah. I mean, let's just leave it on a Friday, I think. So I the 31st, if it works for folks.
Yeah.
I'd appreciate that. So
unless there is a... Is there an opportunity for a different Saturday?
I mean, asking who?
One, I'm asking us as well as staff. Can we move it to the 24th? Is there an issue there?
I can do that.
I mean, that would be preferred, but I don't know if that really crunches staff.
I don't have any problem on 24th, too.
Yeah.
Staff have a problem?
Should be okay. I'm looking at Jacqueline on when we're going to get the budget out, because we'll probably get the budget to you maybe that week of the 5th or the 12th, so you may not have a whole lot of time with it before that Saturday, but if that's all right, that's okay with us.
All right, we'll go with the 24th.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We said what time, so we can put it on there, you know.
8 a.m.?
We generally would start at 8 a.m.
8 a.m., okay.
All right. We'll be here that Saturday, the 24th. Great.
And then
let's look at any other dates we need to nail down right now. Kelly, that you think?
That was the only one that really we didn't have a set date on. Sure. I know you had mentioned to have folks look at the tentative schedule to see if there was any conflicts with anything else.
Yeah, and I think if we can just take a look and make sure that we don't have, sometimes we don't want to schedule something on an event that we know typically happens in the city, or a holiday that could affect one of us up here, or we would like off and not meeting. So if we can review those dates.
I forget when the CIP date is. 21st. Wednesday the 21st, yeah.
I don't have anything.
Hearing nothing. All right, we can always revise it as we go along. We're going to move on to item number 4, which is an update on housing authority planning. And Tracy Heishu is coming on up. Okay. Welcome.
Thank you, Mayor. I'm pleased to welcome Kayla Stanfield from Baker Tilly. As part of the Pro Housing Grant, the city engaged Baker Tilly to help strengthen the Housing Authority's organizational effectiveness, to increase our financial sustainability, and look at how we create a pathway to develop internally affordable housing. So previously you heard a presentation from Quadell. This is not to be confused. Quadell's presentation was how to reposition our public housing units out of the public housing program into a Section 8 platform. This strategic plan considers us moving forward with the repositioning and managing our own housing portfolio outside the public housing program. So tonight, Kayla will focus on the strategic plan and pathways to expand our affordable housing, our development options, and discuss our operating model. And just as a footnote, we have one of those items on your agenda tonight, the hiring of financial coordinator. So welcome, Kayla.
Welcome.
Hi, thank you. Mayor, Council, and City Leadership Team, thank you for having me today as we give an update on the strategic plan and operating model. I also have two other team members that are joining virtually today, Caitlin Hummerkaus, who is a principal with Baker Tilly, and Caitlin Ness, who is a consultant as well. So they will be interjecting some comments throughout the PowerPoint as we go today. Right. First, just a high-level agenda is that we'll give an overview of the strategic planning process, and then we'll go into some more information on what the actual strategic planning elements were. And then we have some recommendations on the development and organizational structure for you all. And then we'll end with some implementation recommendations and some next steps. So beginning with the strategic planning overview, we're going to cover the scope, the phases that were part of the strategic planning project, and the stakeholder engagement that was involved in it. Our scope here was to provide a comprehensive evaluation of the current operations and provide a detailed roadmap for the future. We assessed the organizational structure. We looked at staffing levels. We also did some peer benchmarking and the efficiency of the staff roles and the responsibilities. We analyzed some pathways for increasing development of housing opportunities, and we facilitated a strategic planning process which consisted of multi-year strategic planning. And as Tracy mentioned, Baker Tilly is also serving as the development manager for the pilot project. So here are the four phases that entail the project, and so we're currently in phase four, but the project began in May of 2025 with a kickoff meeting where we sat down with the staff to decide what the scope was going to look like, who would be involved in the stakeholder engagement, and those deliverables that we would present to you all. In phase two, we did a lot of heavy stakeholder engagement and the analysis. We did document review, data review of existing documentation. We had multiple documents that we requested from the staff so that we can do a thorough analysis. And then we had stakeholder interviews with internal and external partners. And then we did benchmarking assessment as well. And then in phase three, we came on site here in July, and we did a strategic planning workshop with your leadership team and with the housing team. And then we've done some organizational, legal, and financial review as part of our assessment. And so now here we are. We are presenting our findings thus far for the strategic plan, and then we'll be providing, after updates today, the final strategic planning document, which will also consist of a communication strategy on how to get those changes and when changes are made, as well as an implementation action plan also. So just a brief overview of what those stakeholder interviews look like. We interviewed members of your city leadership team. We also interviewed the Iowa City Housing Authority staff, and then we also interviewed some of your external community partners in some similar housing type programs here in Iowa City. So during those interviews, we gave them an opportunity to share their insights, things that were going well, things that they had to recommend, and also give us some ideas on some of the strategic objectives that they would like to achieve. They were asked targeted questions on the organizational aspects, operational, financial, and service delivery also. And so after all of those interviews, we took the information and we synthesized those themes that we heard that were recurring themes, and we provided the staff with a Discover summary report. And then, as I mentioned, we were here July 22nd and July 23rd, and we met with the Iowa City leadership team. And so we conducted a full workshop where we helped identify who Iowa City Housing Authority's customer was, or their main customers that they wanted to identify. And then we talked about a vision, a mission statement, and then we identified with them strategic goals and objectives and initiatives that would tie into those identified goals. So here's just a snapshot of the deliverables that we've provided throughout this project. So we provided the Discover Phase Summary Report. We also provided a document that had the strategic planning workshop results in it. We'll be finalizing the final strategic plan and operating model in a report, and also we'll be providing an implementation action plan. So just a little bit more in this next part of the agenda of what the strategic plan actually looks like. So the elements that we looked at were the vision statement, the mission statement, strategic goals and objectives, strategic operating initiatives, and we also identified some of the gaps that we heard and observed during the workshop and during those interviews to help us guide some of those recommendations. So after the Iowa City Housing Authority team identified who their main customers were and the types of services that they wanted to continue to provide and or new services that they wanted to provide, we were able to use that information to come up with a vision and mission statement. And so the vision statement that they came up with was strengthening communities through affordable housing. And then the mission statement, to be a collaborative leader in affordable housing through programs, partnerships, and policies that help all residents thrive with a commitment to respect and service excellence. So we felt that that really fit what the goal was for the Housing Authority, both now and into the future as well. And through the workshop, they identified five high-level goals to focus on. So goal number one was to increase stakeholder opportunities and prosperity. Goal number two, to develop internal financial management capacity. Goal number three, preserve and expand affordable housing units. Goal number four, to enhance organizational capacity and structure. And goal number five, to implement technology effectively. And so each of the five goals, the team focused on creating a definition for each of the goals. And then they also assigned initiatives that would tie into those goals. Not all of the initiatives are starting over from scratch. We also incorporated things that they were already working on that were in progress as well. And so we won't go over necessarily every single one of the goals that's listed here, but there's a few that we're going to point out throughout today's presentation. So the first one there, you'll see number one was to increase the number of residents in the Family Self-Sufficiency Program. So this one was important because this HUD initiative helps families in subsidized housing achieve economic independence and reduce the reliance on assistance. And so some of the goals of the Family Self-Sufficiency Program is to have goal setting and a coach that will help them set employment, education, and financial goals. And they also gives them an opportunity to create an escrow savings account. So some of the benefits of this program are savings growth, skill development, support services, and a path to independence. And you'll see there on point number three, point number four was to utilize full capacity of specialty vouchers for high barrier residents. And so this is another initiative through HUD programming. And this targeted populations that have significant barriers to stable housing. And so in this program, they're usually distributed through referral systems that prioritize them with the highest needs. And so some of the target areas are those that have chronic homelessness, severe mental health or physical health needs, history of institutionalism, might be victims of domestic violence or human trafficking, youth that are aging out of the foster care system, and maybe some that have poor rental or challenges with credit history as well. So the purpose of this is to really help families achieve that housing stability and reduce their reliance on emergency systems as well. So goal number two was to develop the internal financial management capacity, and you'll see those initiatives listed on this slide. As mentioned, you'll be talking a little bit more later about the financial coordinator, but this was one of the things that we identified as a recommendation through our research, because as the Housing Authority is looking to expand their services, there is a need to bring in this particular position because there's different funding sources, compliance regulations, and reporting mechanisms. And as we analyze the staffing, they're at capacity for being able to accomplish all of these tasks that would be needed to cover the expanded services. And now I'm going to hand this piece over to Kaylin Nuss to cover the HCV admin reserves.
Hi, good evening. Can everybody hear me okay?
Yes, we can hear you.
Great. Thanks so much for having me, Kaylin Nuss. When speaking with the team in Iowa, we talked about the need for Section 8 reserves. So what is a Housing Choice Voucher Admin Reserve? It is the essentially a savings account for housing authorities who are funded through HUD and allocate housing choice voucher programs or traditional tenant-based Section 8. The purpose for the admin funds is to provide a buffer against fluctuations in funding or demand. So it helps ensure continuous funding stability. Obviously, in the last few months, we've had some uncertainty in the federal government. That's exactly when housing choice voucher admin reserves are to be used. Program funds can be used for that program stability, so covering shortfalls when HUD funding is delayed or reduced so families don't lose housing support. It could also be used for voucher expansion, so supporting additional vouchers when demand exceeds baseline allocations. So if you need more vouchers out on the street, special initiatives such as landlord outreach, housing mobility programs, operational flexibility. The reserves can be used to help with the administrative costs such as technology upgrades or staffing needs. These can be also referred to as like management improvement opportunities. So later we'll talk about how the agency is working through some technology upgrades. The reserves can be used for the purposes of training and implementation of that software system. That is all I had right now on the Housing Choice Voucher admin reserves.
I have a question on that.
I have a question.
Oh, it's probably the same one. I want to know how much we have in our current housing reserve. And I could wait to the end, I guess.
Richard Carter with the Housing Authority. I think that we looked at it yesterday, and we have $3.17 million in the admin reserve right now.
Great. Thanks.
And also, I have a question. I don't know, is this, she said like expansion of housing voucher, or what was exactly she said? One of the things is expansion of the housing voucher. Like having more voucher, that what it means, or?
Yeah, so one of the eligible uses for voucher expansion is that if you have excess reserves, you can use those to put more vouchers on the street. I will caution housing authorities. This is a risky practice because once your reserves are gone, you may not be able to renew vouchers. And so HUD will certainly, if you're continually operating, using your reserves as part of your general operations and not as like a specialty focus or a special project, you'll have to work really closely to make sure you're not over obligating and then have to call back vouchers in the future.
And also, is this can be also using of like, I don't know what the word that I should use here, but you know like sometimes the vouchers for 3-bedroom is 1700 or something like that, and the market price is 1900. Is this cannot be expansion of the voucher itself? Like increasing the threshold of the...
Yeah, so I think what you're referring to is your payment standards. Uh-huh. And so that's speaking directly to how much funds can be used for a voucher by bedroom size. That's something that the Housing Authority evaluates annually, what their payment standards are going to be. And they have to work very closely with HUD to develop what they call a two-year tool. And that just forward forecasts how much voucher allocation they have to spend on the street to make sure they don't run into what is called a Section 8 shortfall. And that's where you have more commitments on the street than your eligible subsidy coming in to pay for it is.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, because that's one of the really problem happening right now in the community. I thought maybe we can figure out a solution for it. Yes, people find houses, but the voucher is not covering it.
Thank you. We'll move on to goal number three, and that is the goal of preserving and expanding affordable housing units. And so the key one we wanted to point out on here is in parallel with Baker Tilly's development advisory team, they have been supporting the executing the pilot project. And so that initiative is to self-develop affordable housing units on vacant city-owned property to alleviate the pressure on the existing affordable housing unit housing stock and provide much-needed support for the citizens of Iowa City. And so far, partnering with us, they have analyzed and chosen a site. They've completed some draft architectural massing and zoning confirmation. And they've put together a preliminary capital plan as well. So as this preliminary work is completed, the next step is to procure an architect and begin the process of designing the building and the site. And this process is going to involve multiple public review periods to ensure that the project pilot is a success for the neighbors as well and those in the community. And we'll also be assisting and soliciting the best financing options for that as well. And then they will select a general contractor that will lead you all through a public procurement process.
I'm curious to understand how expansive, when in this particular setting, of the preservation of affordable housing is. Does it include the city-owned affordable housing and all housing that's under that 30% of your gross income in the city that might not really be part of a city program, or is it really just focused on the ones that the city has some level of control over?
I'm talking about what we are doing and what this contract's for?
Well, when the goal is to preserve and expand affordable housing, yes, great. Let's do a lot of that.
Yeah.
But my curiosity is, I know that if we purchase an already existing unit that's providing what would be market rate affordable housing in the city, we're maybe not benefiting the whole city. We're just transferring one from one owner to a different owner. So that's why I'm curious in your analysis, or what is definition of affordable housing? Is it just narrowly focused on the city's affordable housing, or the whole city, the city-owned one, government-owned ones versus all?
Depends on which hat we're wearing. So for this study, we're preserving our housing, our public housing units that get repositioned to Section 8 platform,
mm-hmm. Okay.
as well as maintaining those units. So we have 86 in the public housing. We have 24 units outside public housing. So we have 123-ish units. We need to preserve those. We need to sustainably operate those, that we cash flow and that we provide the maintenance and the repair that they need. We look to build and that to increase that portfolio. So we'll go from 123 units to 140, 150, 160, right. 170 that we're operating. Now, in other programs outside the housing authority, we will use our CDBG home funds, affordable housing fund, to work with the community to preserve community-wide sure. affordable housing.
And for the purposes of expansion for this, it wouldn't include expansion to include existing affordable housing. It would be all new construction, new.
That's what our focus is on. Okay. That's what the pilot project, that's what's to take
okay.
to teach us
sorry
new construction.
Sorry to sort of jump ahead,
you
if
know,
that's what
I don't
I'm
want
doing,
to limit, but especially with the loss reserve, loss funds coming up. You know, maybe we have opportunity to acquire new construction that typically would not be affordable. Okay. But our intention, as I see it right now, is not to buy affordable housing stock that's affordable in the market and convert that just to subsidized housing. So our concentration will be on acquisition of new construction or to build it ourselves.
Okay.
If I'm answering your question.
Yeah, that's very helpful. Sorry. I just the term affordable housing has many different meanings in different contexts,
yeah.
and I
yeah.
want to make sure which yep. version we were using here.
Okay.
So
right,
thank
great.
You.
Thanks.
Good question. Yeah.
Question. I suppose my question was, and I think I might be jumping ahead a little bit, so apologies if that's what is happening, but the admin funds we have right now, did I hear that was $3.7 million around there?
$3.17 million.
And as we're talking about, this is something for months I've been thinking about, you know, as we're talking about expanding our housing authorities operations, you know, obviously that will include more staff, the more and more units that we need to maintain and manage. And I know that the housing authority is already cramped where it is. And so one thing I've been thinking about is it keeps me up at night a little bit, is just making sure that we have like the physical space capacity for expanding our housing authority so we can take on that extra what we want to do. So am I misunderstanding what we were just talking about in terms, were you talking about risks of maybe using some of those funds we have right now? Because to me, what keeps me up at night is just not spending that money that could potentially be clawed back with our uncertain federal environment. So there's a question in there somewhere, I suppose. I suppose, am I interpreting that correctly?
Oliver, this is Kaylin Nuss. You're absolutely correct. There is a risk of potential clawbacks if those federal funds are not spent, which is why it was highlighted as one of the findings of that is a significant amount of reserves. HUD will mandate you have a specific level, and the team in the Housing Authority are very aware of what the minimum requirements are, but your reserve levels are far above that at this time. And so really it's evaluating what are the possible uses available to the community and what is the right fit. Certainly using some of the funds to aid in relocation or expansion of services specific to the Section 8 staff would be allowable. Funds could not be used for things that are not related to the Section 8 team. So it would have to come down to the staffing and who reports to which budget.
Thank you.
All right, if no other questions, we'll move into goal number 4. And this was to enhance the organizational capacity and structure. And so this one, we do have some recommendations that we'll be sharing on the organizational structure in a few slides ahead. But one of the things that we did want to point on this one is bullet point number 5 there, and it's a rebrand, and it is prioritized as something that may not occur right away, but something that we wanted to draw your attention to. As we did the interviews and the workshop, this was something that was a resounding theme across your internal and external stakeholders, and part of it would be as you're working on new strategic initiatives, as you're expanding your services, sometimes it might require, it is recommended to kind of really look at your branding and what that might imply, not only just for the public perception, but to really clarify the identity and the role that the Housing Authority is going to play, as well as it shows the support of change across the board, and it will also build that trust and engagement from your participants and your community as well. One of the things that was pointed out in our analysis is that you do have other counties that are part of the Housing Authority as participants. And so having a name that is associated with just one of the particular counties can create some misunderstandings as to who you serve and who the reach is for the Housing Authority. And then goal number 5 was to implement technology effectively. And this is one of the areas where the Housing Authority has already started several of the items listed here, such as identifying some software to make their processes more effective and some process improvement opportunities they have already begun on. We wanted to make sure that that was still a high-level goal of continually to improve the technology efficiently. Mm-hmm. And with that, I'm going to hand over the next section of this over to Kaylin Nuss and to Caitlin Hummerkaus to cover the development model and the organizational structure recommendations.
Great. Thanks, Kayla, so much. So first, I wanted to just outline that based on conversations with Iowa earlier, we discussed that the vision and mission statements were to be evolved. And when focusing in on those vision and mission statements, it's clear that your city and your housing authority are very proactive in finding solutions to meet the needs of your affordable housing community. The vision statement of strengthening communities through affordable housing is a very strong statement, and I applaud you for creating a focus on that. Housing authorities across the country have taken this more proactive approach to development, not necessarily out of aspiration, but a hint of desperation. The reality is we are in a true affordable housing crisis. Every community needs it. And it's really up to the leaders to step up to the plate to say, we are going to be a community that creates affordable housing, not just laissez-faire and letting it happen organically. What I've outlined here are 4 possible pathways to creating additional affordable housing in your community. The city can pursue one or multiple. You could go one way and then pivot to a secondary. You could run two pathways simultaneously. It's really a structure that is flexible to meet the needs of what the economy can supply and also what the demand is asking for. So please note that these are interchangeable and can be used at different ways at different times. There is no single quote unquote best pathway. It really needs to be a community driven plan. So the first option here is a co-development pathway. This is where the housing authority will partner with an experienced developer. They will be joint in planning and execution of projects. They'll share in resources, risks, revenues, and it helps the housing authority build capacity through collaboration. There are ways that the housing authority can generate revenue in this option. It could be something where you have a strong developer who is providing financial guarantees. Maybe they're taking 80% of a developer fee. The housing authority is at the table providing nonprofit status or project-based vouchers to a project, and they're going to take 20% of a developer fee and also manage the property once it's complete. The co-development model is very common for smaller communities or housing authorities that have less resources or less experienced staff.
In this co-development model, do you do it for a project or for a period of time?
It could be both and.
Okay.
It could be project by project, or it could be, let's say, for example, your housing authority wants to build capacity. So you're going to use this pathway to building the skills necessary to do your own self-development. Maybe you do it for 3 years or you do it for three projects, whatever it takes for your staff to have the right scalability and then also have enough project generation to be able to afford additional staff resources, et cetera.
And then follow-up question, probably true for multiple of these, but when you're working with a private partner, how do you select that private partner?
That's a really great question. Most communities will do a request for qualifications and solicit development partners through a public procurement process. Sometimes it happens where a developer may have used a similar model in a different community, and then there's piggyback opportunities, intergovernmental contracts can be utilized. But it really is up to your community to decide how you want to approach that.
Thanks.
Can you repeat again what the partner will be look like between the housing authority and this developer, like an ex-developer?
Are you speaking to like what a master development agreement might look like between two partners?
Yeah, no. When you say like co-develop between the housing authority and a developer for LIHTC exactly, like specifically for LIHTC programs, how that's like, what are you envisioning? You said it, but I really didn't get it in the beginning. If you can just say whatever you said in the beginning.
Sure. So in this co-development structure, the housing authority would partner with an experienced developer. So that experienced developer oftentimes will have the staff and skills necessary to do a full development project, but they may be needing in resources such as the nonprofit status, project-based vouchers, other things that your state housing finance agency may mandate, right? And so this is a collaborative co-development opportunity that would be defined under a master development agreement, an MDA, that clearly outlines roles and responsibilities, who's going to be in charge of what, and what any revenue and risks may be shared. So for example, the earlier example I gave was that an experienced for-profit developer may come in and they've got the staff, they've got the engine to create affordable housing, but they're partnering with you, the housing authority, who's going to provide project-based vouchers to their community. You may also be the property manager because maybe they don't have a local property manager, right? So in that particular situation, when you're looking at risk versus reward and revenues, that developer may earn 80% of a developer fee and the housing authority would earn 20%. Now, fees are negotiable. It's going to be very project specific. It really depends on what resources are being brought to the table.
Yeah, that's exactly what I thought I understood. That's why I want to ask you again to make sure. But also, I still have a hard time understanding what the big benefit from partnering with low-income tax credit developer who already there to provide 80% or 30%, like already providing because of the tax credit, they already providing affordable housing. Why should we partner with them by using our vouchers where we can use this voucher for non-like light tech developer who I guess have a market price? Did you understand where I'm coming from?
No, absolutely. I understand your question there. I think the greatest benefit is for the housing authority to work alongside the developer to build their internal capacity. It is also a tool that you can help utilize to incentivize developers to do projects that work for your city. Developers typically come in and they use a model that works for their financial structure, right? And most LIHTC developers are looking to make money and then they exit at year 5 or year 15. In this particular structure, it can be negotiated that the housing authority maintains the right of first refusal, right? So that you can guarantee in 15 years when that tax credit expires, those are not going to, you know, fall out of affordability, but rather that you have some type of control or say in what happens to them. It's also a way for the housing authority to generate revenue. If they are sharing in that developer fee, they can start to assemble a pool of funds that can be used and recycled for future projects. So it's a little bit of the nest egg that as they grow in their skill sets, they're building up a loan pool that they may be able to utilize for future projects. It's helping build internal capacity and keeping those resources in your community instead of a developer coming in, building it, and then leaving.
Okay, thank you.
The second option is self-development with consultant support. And so this is similar to what is happening in the pilot project. This is where a housing authority truly takes the driver's seat and leads the development activities. But we acknowledge that the housing authority may not have all of the skill sets necessary to complete a project from A to Z. And so that's when consultants come in and provide technical and strategic expertise based on the needs of that particular project. It's a more balanced approach that allows you to have control of a process and really driving it, as I said, from A to Z. This will enhance the organizational's learning. So this is, if a co-developer is not looking to partner with the city, right? Let's say you do a request for qualifications, you put it out to the world that you're looking for developers to partner with, and nobody responds. Well, your option is to either do nothing or to take the driver's seat and do it yourself. And so this option is a great in between of like, you want to do it, but maybe you're not quite sure how to do it yet. So you're going back to my earlier of maybe not aspiration, but desperation. The reality is the community needs the affordable housing and nobody else is stepping up to the table to do it. So we are going to take control of our community and what the needs are. And so we're going to do it and we're going to bring in the right partners to help us get the project through.
I had a question.
Yes.
So for me, I guess I could be missing a couple puzzle pieces here, but in terms of us doing it ourselves in this manner or with hiring a consultant, this might be a part of one of the other options that you're going to present, but in terms of just hiring staff with the experience already, is there kind of like a comparison in terms of what is generally the most cost effective or what has worked in other communities? Because I guess in my brain, I just think, okay, we need people with certain skill sets. Don't we just create those positions and hire them?
Oliver, your timing is great because that is a perfect transition into option 3, which is the full self-development. And full self-development is really where the housing authority is operating as a developer. You manage the right people. You oversee all phases of development from site selection, financing, design, construction, compliance. You've got the right team, the internal capacity, expertise, et cetera, and you just do it on your own. There are housing authorities that do this nationally. The majority of these large, or the majority of housing authorities that do full self-development are large authorities. These are ones that have over $50 million in operating revenue. They're the ones that have very large portfolios and extremely large staff to fall back on. If you're looking to go down this full self-development route, it's not an easy calculation to come to, but you're looking at hiring an architect, hiring a site superintendent, hiring, people with finance skills, et cetera. That's a lot of overhead for the city to carry from a payroll perspective. That's why we suggest typically to go through the self-development with a consultant until you have enough internal capacity as you're building out your team to go full self-development. The other thing I will caution is that investors are looking to make sure you have qualified teams and experience. And so you're going to need, 5 years of time and projects to showcase to an investor that you are a worthy organization to work with. It is a risk proposition to go into a deal with someone who's never done it before. And so a lot of communities will require that you have a minimum of 3 tax credit projects under your belt before you can do it on your own. And so that's something that every state is a little different. And Iowa also changes every 2 years what their qualified allocation plan may or may not state. And so you just have to keep a pulse on what does your state require. If you're looking to do tax credits, what are the requirements of the state to apply? And then also, what is the appetite of the investor community? Are they willing to take a risk on you? Do you have the connections to make that happen? Do you have the financial balance sheet to provide financial guarantees, et cetera?
For full self-development, when one needs to require the capacity and experience to qualify as being a qualified developer, do you gain that qualification by being a co-developer, or do you need to be the self-developer with the consultant support?
Majority of states will allow you to earn that experience by being a co-developer. Some states will allow it as self-development with a consultant. It is going to be very much state-specific, and as I mentioned, it can change from year to year. It depends how your qualified allocation plan is written.
Okay.
The last option I wanted to present is really just a contract with a developer. So going back to that mission statement earlier, to be a collaborative leader in affordable housing through programs, partnerships, and policy. That option for contracts with a developer is really a tool to be used when looking to partner with people. So this, to me, is a pathway that is not as fulfilling with the housing authority taking the lead and coordinating these efforts, but rather this is something that may be able to run simultaneously with other efforts. This could be engagement with private developers for land. Like maybe you have land available and you want to do affordable housing, so you're going to do a request for qualifications for affordable housing providers to provide proposals for vacant land, and you're going to sell it to them for a dollar. It could be the tools such as the project-based voucher that you want to just give them away to advance affordable housing in a specific location or for a specific target demographic, et cetera. This is a lower risk, faster delivery model. So if it's something that you need to mobilize very quickly, you want to just contract with a developer and move. My understanding is that your community is already doing this. So I list it as an option just so you know that you can still do it while working through the other options. But also know that you guys have tools in your toolbox and you can use different tools at different points of time depending upon what the needs are.
Mm-hmm. Add another question. So I imagine communities that take on becoming developers themselves, a lot of them probably have different overall goals or different visions for the future, I'm assuming correctly, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So, you know, speaking for myself here, I'm somebody who is extremely excited about the prospect of becoming developers because I view it as like one of the main pieces to creating non-market housing and solving the housing crisis locally is going towards a route where we have a very large, robust housing authority that has a lot of capacity, something like the Vienna model, which the municipality owns 25-30% of all housing in the city, or Singapore or something like that, versus a community that just kind of wants to put their toe in and a little bit to the overall landscape. So I guess my question for you is, are there different options that you would recommend for different goals or different visions for the future?
That's a very good question. I would say that the different options are really going to be contingent on your capacity and expertise on how you can execute. It's also a local choice on the appetite for risk that you all have, the desire to have control, the speed at which you want to pursue it, and truly the financial sustainability of it. This has to be a community-aligned initiative. If you're looking to go the bigger scale, like in the examples that you provided, that's something that the housing authority, in and of itself, cannot financially support. So it would require larger policy changes to have funds available to do that type of large-scale growth and initiatives. It is not impossible. I really just think it depends on what the needs of the community are and what you're willing to put in for resources.
Thank you.
All right, Kayla. That is it as far as the development goes. So transitioning now into the organizational changes, unless there's any other questions.
There's not.
Okay. So as far as organizational changes, Kayla and Caitlin can jump in at any time, but really the goal here is to help in the mission of advancing affordable housing, just high level. What we're looking to do is to elevate the housing authority's role while also freeing up time for the executive director. So right now, the housing authority it's a little confusing to be honest. It's a division within a division within a division, which is not what we commonly see across the country. So our first recommendation was to elevate the housing authority to be its own division, specifically directing the reporting through the director. And so the reason we do this is for a couple of reasons. It's to enhance the credibility of the housing authority. When it's the Iowa City department that falls within three layers under the mayor, it kind of loses credibility. We want to create a sense of efficiency, adaptability, stronger advocacy, create more eyes so that people know who the housing authority is, who it reports to, who oversees it, etc. So having it be a standalone division helps create more outline support.
Will you explain exactly what that means? They would no longer be a department of the city?
They would still be a department of the city, and I apologize, I don't recall the division that they're under right now. So they are Kayla, help me with the layers.
Hey, Caitlin, this is Tracy. So right now the Housing Authority is part of Neighborhood and Development Services. We have three divisions right now, Development Services, MPO, and Neighborhood Services. And then the Housing Authority is a division under Neighborhood Services. So this would create a Housing Authority would be a division just like Development Services, Neighborhood Services, MPO, and it'd be the Housing Authority. So we'd have four divisions instead of three, and then it wouldn't be under Neighborhood Services. So the Housing Authority would be their own division under NDS. If that makes sense.
Still under NDS? No.
Still under NDS. So the executive director of the housing administrator would be a direct report under me.
Got it.
So it'd be Danielle, Erica, Kent, and Rachel.
Got it.
That helps.
Yep. Thank you.
Yep.
Thank you, Tracy. The second item that we had suggested was to change the title of the housing administrator to executive director. This is a nationally recognized title, the executive director. Housing administrator, when discussing in the inner circles of affordable housing and specifically public housing with RAD repositioning, et cetera, that is a confusing title. And so when interacting with the outside community to help create a sense of credibility, we recommend changing that title.
Mm-hmm.
The third item is the creation of the housing counselor position. The housing counselor position strengthens the resident services goal that we discussed earlier by providing a dedicated support and guidance. It also helps alleviate the current housing administrator, hopefully future executive director's role for oversight. So this would be someone who could help achieve the goals of the housing counselor to advance family self-sufficiency and resident engagement support while freeing up time for the executive director to refocus attention to development.
Don't we have already something like family self-sufficient positions?
This would be like a supervisory role for that.
Mm. And how many people we have doing family self-sufficient? Four? Thanks.
And I apologize, I went out of order there. The creation of the financial coordinator position is another strategic investment in long-term strength of the housing authority. So when we start talking about affordable housing and the regulations under Section 8 versus public housing versus rental assistance demonstration versus tax credit versus, you know, CDBG home, it becomes very complex. The other thing I will caution you is that affordable housing, in my time at Baker Tilly, we refer to it as lasagna financing. To get these deals to balance, you have to accept, you know, 5, 6, 7, 8 funding sources, and it makes it extremely financially complex with a lot of different compliance reporting requirements. And so creating a financial coordinator position allows a team to be very dedicated in reviewing the financials, being prepared for the complexities of the compliance and future reporting. So this would be an investment in bringing someone in now, having the organization becomes stable in that financial coordinator role while slowly adding on additional complexities as the development team is successful. The last item is the development manager. And I think a development manager is really focused to free up time for the executive director. As you take on additional projects, a development manager can help facilitate the needs of the organization and manage projects on behalf of that executive director. So it could be someone who can coordinate with your tax credit investors, someone who can connect with your general contractors. It really is a special projects person, and that development manager could be something that is filled temporarily based on the needs of the project, or could become a full-time position based on the pipeline of growth that the housing authority is able to achieve.
With these new positions, would the dollars for these lines be able to be spent with those reserves, with some of the reserves that we have, or is this general fund?
Are you referring to how we can continue funding this? That's what you said.
Well, I'm just wondering, with new positions that we don't have yet,
yes, I know,
how do we pay for them?
With the financial coordinator position, that is something, and Rachel, please feel free to take lead here. The financial coordinator, because it is supporting Section 8, that is an eligible expense for reserves.
Right.
When it comes to the development, that would have to be paid for, ideally out of those fees that you're earning as a developer fee for the projects that you have in your pipeline.
What about the housing also?
Yeah, what Kaylin said is correct. Oh, the financial coordinator position can be absorbed in our current admin reserves and what we get annually from HUD for those admin fees.
Right, right.
The housing counselor position, we actually wrote that into the Pro Housing Grant when we applied for it. So we have some funds for a couple years through the Pro Housing Grant for the housing counseling position. And we believe that we're able to sustain that within Housing Authority Enterprise funds. We're wanting to really flush out, make sure our federal funding is in place before we come to you with the creation of that position, which is why you haven't seen it yet. We want to make sure we have sustainable funding for it before we make that request. Right now, we believe we'll be able to sustain it, but we want to make sure, which is why we haven't brought it to you yet.
Right. Just start the pipeline.
You mentioned that the financial coordinator position will be paid by HUD.
Yep, we can sustain it with our current HCV admin fees that we receive monthly from HUD.
And for the, what is it, normally what, like, the reserve that we have, normally now these new positions, what we were doing with the reserve money before, is this also could be like creation of new affordable housing or like anything else or it has to be only administration?
Yeah, only administration. We're not able to use it for hard units, is what HUD would call a physical unit. So we can't buy or develop or purchase units with these funds.
So that's why it's administration funding. So
yep.
Okay, good. Yeah.
Thank you.
Kind of want to connect the development pathways slide with this recommended organizational changes slide. Are these recommendations the same for development pathways 1, 2, and 4, just not self-development? Would these recommendations be the same for the co-development, self-development, or contract development pathways is what you use? Or would these recommendations be different for different choices and development pathways?
No, these recommendations would be the same, except for that full self-development. You would need a larger scale team to be able to do that. But for, you know, options 1, 2, and 4, these three positions help alleviate the burden of the executive director's administrative oversight right now to free up time to focus on development.
So in pathway 4, where you contract with a developer, you would still want an in-house contract developer to work with the out-of-house developer. Is that correct?
Yeah, so the title we used is development manager. That really can, it's adaptable. It could be like a special projects manager, right? This is just the person who is the main point of contact to help facilitate those
The owner's representative. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, and I think we should clarify that that function doesn't have to be, you know, we think of that as a function and not a position. So with the self-development, with the consultant support, that development management could be provided through the contract with the consultant. Mm-hmm. So there's sort of different ways to get to that function that doesn't have to be a full-time employee.
Okay. And normally that will be funded by the fund from the develop the project fund, right? For this basic, if the development managers is, if I understood it correctly, the one who gonna take care of all the development for new project, for example, if that's really paid by the new project funding, or this is have to be part of the housing authority reserve or any another, like, I don't know, city money, I don't know.
Ideally, it can be paid for by the project. It really depends on your partnerships and what the projects you're looking to advance are. There's always value in having city funds allocated to this specific role if that is a strategic priority for the city to advance affordable housing. Having funds available to have a person to lead those initiatives is always a good investment up front, and then the project can help support it in years 2, 3, and beyond.
And that's something used to be covered by the executive, by the housing administrator, right, before?
Correct.
Okay.
I was going to ask again about, you know, we're talking about some new positions, and I hear you explaining right now that it isn't necessarily a new position, as in we hire a staff, but it could be through the consultant. But I just think about in terms of the physical limitations of our current facilities and how we do need to expand. I was just wondering if that was taken into consideration at all, or what, you know, Rachel, who works in there every day, thinks, if this is something that's feasible and wouldn't, something in space wouldn't need to be addressed first before we do this.
That's definitely one of the recommendations or initiatives that's listed in one of the goals. And so these, again, are just recommendations for positions that we see based on the expansions of your services. But that would definitely need to be a physical logistics assessment that would need to be done, and how everyone would be placed to do their roles effectively.
Thank you.
I was going to add, this is Jeff Oliver. The topic of office space is we cover that ground quite a bit here in the last year. We know that there's additional office space needed for the Housing Authority. There's a lot of variables in play right now, including some of these decisions, you know, before you today, in terms of how many staff are we going to add, what type of approach are we going to take. Rachel mentioned uncertainty with future federal funding. How that space is paid for. Currently, the Housing Authority is not paying rent here in City Hall, right? So we could lease space out there, but that's an additional administrative expense. We can only charge the Section 8 staff. So then you got to figure out the public housing staff, and we're also repositioning those public housing units. So I feel like there's about six or seven balls in the air that we're juggling. And from my perspective, I'd like a few of those decisions to be made and variables to be resolved. And then I think we can make some decisions on where that space goes. But there's shared understanding here within the staff that the space that's currently housing the Housing Authority is not adequate.
Thank you.
Yeah. Are there any additional questions on the organizational recommendations?
Great. Kayla, I'm ready to cover the legal structure if you want to move to that slide. Thanks. Hi, everyone. This is Caitlin now. So as you, going back to sort of the other project, you know, Tracy mentioned at the beginning that you're working through with Quadel, your repositioning. As part of that repositioning process, those housing units that you reposition have to go into a different legal structure. So there are two options for that as you reposition. Those can be placed into a nonprofit entity. They can be placed into an LLC. The one that we have been having the most discussion with the Housing Authority team, as well as your legal team at the city, is around the nonprofit entity. It's very common in the Housing Authority world to have a nonprofit affiliate that is part of the housing entity, or related to the housing entity, wholly owned by the housing entity, we should say. Exactly, because HUD requires you to transfer these units into a separate entity from the Housing Authority. So it's not uncommon. And we're working through the specifics of what the governance might look like for that with your legal team. I know that they're getting ready to make a recommendation around that, and we'll bring it before you. But just some kind of notes on that related to if you were to create the nonprofit entity. The nonprofit actually holds the title to the property. The Public Housing Authority really retains control of that housing by how you set up the board structure and the governance structure for that entity. So we typically see things like overlapping or semi-overlapping boards, which would mean that the board of this nonprofit entity would be made up of city council or mayoral appointees plus city staff. The executive director of the nonprofit would be the executive director of the Housing Authority. And so there's that overlap and continuity of decision making. this is, you would have the tax-exempt 501c3 status, which allows some additional access to grants and charitable donations. There are some benefits, unique benefits to the LLC structure when it comes to sort of LIHTC investments and things like that, but that can always be, you can always create an LLC affiliate at another point in time. But, you know, there's the, as I said, the specifics of this are still being worked through and sort of it's complex. And so I know that the team will be bringing a recommendation around this and some more details, but we did want to touch on it today as it was part of what we started to explore during our reporting process.
With the nonprofit structure, do you forego some opportunities for, when you described the lasagna of funding, for some tax credits? I hear you've described LIHTC, but I know that you'll rely on multiple other tax credits, brownfield tax credits or historic tax credits. Do you lose that opportunity with the nonprofit structure?
This is Caitlin. That is correct. If you are looking at a low-income housing tax credit or other tax credit, in order to receive that benefit, it has to be structured as a for-profit company. That is how it's structured. That's typically through an LLC. Sometimes it's put into an LP. But yes, that would be a different structure. My understanding based on the Quidel report out is that for the RAD conversion specifically for your existing public housing, the tax credit structure may not be necessary and hasn't been evaluated. So at this time, it could be put into a nonprofit entity structure. And then if at some point in the future, you do need to recapitalize or go after additional credits to reinvest in that existing public housing, then you could convert it to that LLC structure where the nonprofit owner becomes a general partner and 0.01% owner.
Ah, okay. So you're not stuck with one or the other. You can just add a...
That's correct. You can adjust it.
Syndicate friend, yeah.
I'm okay.
All right. So next we'll look at some implementation and next steps for the project. So one of the things or deliverables that we're providing to the Housing Authority is what we call an implementation action plan. So we'll be taking some of these decision points and the analysis that we had and provide you with steps, who would be responsible for overseeing some of the initiatives. We also have, we'll be providing some key performance indicators as well on how you'll be able to track to make sure that progress is being made. So it'll create that continuous improvement also and provide insight also as to when things should be reviewed and how often the strategic plan should be updated. So just some next steps. So we're taking all the information from today's discussion and we will be providing the Housing Authority with a final report of the strategic plan and the operating model recommendations. And then that way they'll be able to move on into starting that implementation action plan. And we're also going to be providing a thorough change management plan, which will highlight how the changes should be communicated, whether it's staffing, whether it's building changes, just all the many different things that will be happening throughout the next few years as the strategic plan moves forward, and who should be part of that messaging, how often it should go out, with the frequency, and what methods should be used as well.
Will community members or, you know, voucher holders, et cetera, will they also be impacted? I mean, will this be something that information that they should know as
yes,
well?
Yes, and in that communication strategy plan, we're providing who, what, when, mm-hmm. where, why.
Yeah.
The communication should go out to staff, leadership team, and the community as well.
Okay, yeah. I just, based on just the presentation, you know, this has been much more internally focused, and I just wondered once these changes start to happen, you know, their stakeholders too. So thank you.
And then last, we just have some routine strategic plan updates, some recommendations. We usually recommend that there's like a quarterly update on your KPIs that'll be brought to the leadership team, as well as just being transparent to your community as well. And looking at management should be looking at it a year in review as well. Oftentimes, we recommend that some of the updates be presented during your budgeting process also. that brings us to the end of our presentation. We thank you for the opportunity to share the updates with you all, and thank you for getting me out of Phoenix and enjoying some cool weather for today.
Can I ask one question? And I'm sorry, this was way back when you were talking about goal number one. And so it's sort of a very generalized question because you had a lot of specifics. But as I was taking down notes, the synthesis that I had was that essentially goal number one was about increasing housing and programming. And a number of the bullets really had to do with sort of for more challenging situations that some individuals face. And yet, increasingly, we've seen over the past several months that HUD seems particularly bent on cutting a lot of programming for situations that are intended to help those situations and individuals facing that. So I just wondered, in terms of recent kind of environmental and policy, actually not environmental, policy shifts from HUD, how does that, can you perhaps look at, give me an example of how that you can point to that reconciles some of the goals that you have that reconcile this apparent contradiction with the policies that seem to be moving, that HUD is moving towards?
That was a really good question.
I'm sorry. I was sort of, you know, I mean, I'm trying to be specific enough and yet general. It just seems that there's a real contradiction here.
Sure. So in that goal number one that you mentioned, the initiatives have their increased number of residents in the Family Self-Sufficiency Program. Oh, thanks, Kayla.
Thank you.
So I think, as you've all seen, 3 years ago, we had one Family Self-Sufficiency Coordinator. We've grown to four. HUD would like to give us five, and we don't have the capacity for that. Okay. We're going to stick with four. And part of this is, as we increase to four, we have to increase the number of residents we're serving. What we see consistently over the last 25 years is that both the Senate and the House, every year in the budget negotiations at the congressional level, they support the Family Self-Sufficiency Program. It's really kind of the darling program of the PHA world. It shows significantly positive results. It shows so many people leaving the Section 8 program to self-sufficiency, essentially. We have many of our FSS participants move to homeownership. We also have a very strong program nationally. Mm-hmm. We have some of the strongest statistics that there are in PHAs for the FSS program, which is a real testament to what our staff do on a daily basis. And so while you're absolutely correct that we're really seeing some conflicting information coming federally about what they're supporting, we're also seeing in the budget conversations, FSS continues to be supported at the House level and the Senate level. So we'll continue to move forward with the path that our funders are giving to us. HUD continues to have positive remarks to us about our FSS program. We just applied for our next round of funding, and we received positive remarks on that application. So there's that FSS. Part of this is increasing service offerings to family self-sufficiency participants. While we have great numbers and we continue to show great success in our FSS program, we always have room to grow. We continue to have new challenges. Today was Community Connections Day that the Housing Authority is deeply involved in. We had 203 people there today. Last year we had 60. Wow. So we're continuing to see a great need. Yeah. And as we see that need increase and change, we need to increase our services and change how we're offering these and be innovative in what we're providing to our residents. So that's kind of what that's addressing. You know, when we know better, we do better, and we're knowing better, so we're trying to do better right now. And the rest is, you know, the housing counseling program, I think that we mentioned, we're cautiously approaching that path with the understanding that some of those federal priorities have been shifting. Landlord incentives, probably some of you have seen that we announced some landlord incentives, which has been a really popular item. My email is very busy right now with it. And especially vouchers, I think that that's where we're going to see the opportunity to show some of our innovation and our flexibility as city leaders in how we approach the changes at a federal level. And we don't know what those look like yet. I think we're starting to get a taste for what that looks like for some federal funding sources for rapid rehousing services because of the release of the NOFO for those last week. And we don't know what that will look like for us yet. It seems that we're hearing the voucher funding is safe, but how we're collaborating with our community partners may shift as their funding streams shift.
Sure. Well, thank you. That's actually really heartening to know that at the level that you're working at, that there's still the support, the funding is there for the specific programs, and the fact that you've been able to pivot, adapt, and be innovative to meet needs. So thank you, because, if you just sort of look at the overarching, it's pretty scary, and so I'm glad that actually we don't have to jettison goal number one. So thank you very much.
All right, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Great. Any other discussion by council? And wondering if staff need anything from us today.
Nothing more today.
All right, hearing nothing else, we're going to move on to item number 5, which is food discussion. We're going to have our city manager, Jeff Ruin, start us.
Yeah, I'm just going to do a really quick introduction. This was an item that Mayor and Mayor Pro Tem thought would be timely. It certainly is on the agenda. And when thinking about how to present it, one of the ideas that came was to have the United Way of Johnson and Washington counties come up and talk about the COAD. If you're not familiar with the COAD, that's the Community Organizations Active in Disaster. So essentially a team that is meeting regularly that can assemble quick action plans to respond when something comes up. And I thought that would be a good introduction for you all and for the public to understand a little bit more about that, and then to learn about how the COAD came together, or has come together, continues to come together in the moment of food crisis that we found ourselves in the last few weeks. And then after the United Way, we have Shannon McMahon here from city staff to give you a little bit of update on our food drive and promotion efforts. So great. Sounds good. I'll have Emily Meister from United Way of Johnson and Washington counties come up.
Great. Welcome.
Hello. Good evening. I'm Emily Meister. I'm with United Way of Johnson and Washington Counties, and I am our Director of Community Impact and Engagement, and also chair our COAD. I've got Nikki Ross from Table to Table who joined tonight, and when we start getting into some of the specifics for what our food pantries are experiencing, she's going to come up and be able to give a little more information on that. Jeff, thank you for the introduction and what a COAD is. I want to give just a little bit of history about the COAD here in Johnson County. It actually began in 2008 after those big floods, and that was in partnership with Johnson County Emergency Management. And a COAD is not a term specific to Johnson County. They're all over the country. There's also VOADs, a volunteer organization active in disaster, or LTRGs, which are long-term recovery groups. And they're all similar, but essentially, they are a coalition of community partners that can be nonprofits, individuals, local governments, funders that come together and meet regularly in order to support official government response and expand on that when that's not applicable. The COAD came together in 2008. It was very needed then. Our emergency management wasn't, of course, not able to meet every single need of our community members who were effective. And that group met and was fairly stable and productive for quite a few years. But out of sight, out of mind, when we didn't have another really large scale disaster in our community for a while, that group kind of lost energy. So we've at United Way spent the last 2 years really working hard to build that back up and build the capacity back up. We were able to respond to a tornado in March of 2023. That was kind of right at the beginning, and we were able to quickly learn what some of those gaps were. A fire in April of this year, that was a much more coordinated response, but still showed the areas where we need to improve. One of those is that we need a shared leadership structure within the COAD. So by the emergency support functions with Johnson County Emergency Management, United Way is named as the coordinator for this COAD, and that puts me automatically in the position of the chair for that committee. However, there's a lot more people in this community, a lot more very important partners who need to be involved in that work. So one of the first things we did was develop this leadership structure. We now have representation from Johnson County Public Health, Emergency Management, several other nonprofit organizations, social services on a steering committee, and then we've developed subcommittees that can work towards specific items. We have a volunteer management committee, a long-term recovery group, a unmet needs group, and I can't remember them all off the top of my head right now, but the idea is to bring in community leaders to be able to take their expertise and bring it to the table when we need to respond. A lot of times when we think of emergencies, we think of natural disasters. There's also public health emergencies. So COVID was a time when the COAD did assemble a little bit. This time with the SNAP emergency, which is what we're calling it because it truly was that, it became a public health crisis when 10,000 Johnson County residents very quickly lose access to their food sources. Fortunately, we have a really collaborative community, and we have a group called the Food Access Network that has come together within the last year. That's made up of 18 different food access partners in Johnson County, Table to Table being one of them that does food rescue and transportation. But we also have our three large pantries with Coralville, North Liberty, and Community in Iowa City, a lot of neighborhood pantries, school pantries, so a really wide breadth of food access partners have come together. And because of that, and because that structure already existed, we as a COAD were able to take our lead from that group and make sure that the response that we're sharing out with the community as a whole is guided by those that are closest to the work. The main points that we've been sharing throughout this disruption are, one, how to find accurate information, which honestly was the hardest thing to share, especially in the days coming up to that. People didn't know if their benefits were going to be available after October 31st. And so we tried to go the safest route, but also acknowledge that that was a re-traumatization and a crisis for those affected over and over again as the information kept changing. We pointed people to local food resources that they could rely on. We guided people towards 211, either to call or online to find other resources. And then we tried to direct the community support in the most effective way. One such way was to encourage folks to support their local food pantries and those existing partners that are already doing the work. Additionally, we launched at United Way a Food Access Network Relief Fund where individuals who wanted to donate to the collective but also wanted to make sure that their funds were local could donate to this food network fund. And then within the coalition of the Food Access Network, they could decide amongst themselves how to equitably distribute those funds to do bulk food purchasing and really make the best use of them. Additionally, we shared out communication about food drives. If anyone wanted to do really large-scale food drives and wanted to support all of the food pantries or all of the food access partners instead of just one, we could help coordinate that, and then Table to Table will help with the distribution and get the right items to the right food pantries. And then lastly, just encouraging residents who see an unmet need to try to connect with the network and make sure that those ideas and that energy is best utilized in the support, not to discourage mutual aid and making dinner for your neighbor or seeing someone you know personally and supporting them, but when you want to get involved on a larger community level to really put that energy and time and resources into these existing partners. So that was kind of the philosophy around our response. And like I said, very much guided by the Food Access Network. So I want to just give a couple of data points on what that looks like, what this disruption looked like in Johnson County. So we have 10,000 residents who rely on SNAP benefits in Johnson County with a total of $1.7 million every month. So when you think about what that's $1.7 million worth of food, but that's also increased when we think about the economic benefit to our community. So it becomes more than just about the food available, that is the most crucial part. Thankfully, we found out on Friday that EBT cards were filled and that individuals received their benefits, which was great news. And I know that a lot of people were very relieved. We also want to acknowledge that there is some after effects from a situation like this. And Nikki's going to start to share a little bit about that and just continue to make sure that even though this is not as high profile in the headlines as it has been, it's still going to be a really significant need for our community to continue supporting our food access and our food security. So, Nikki, would you like to share?
Hi, I'm Nikki Ross. I'm the executive director at Table to Table, and we help facilitate the Food Access Network. We are, despite it being a crisis and something unnecessary and terrible to have to respond to, we are incredibly proud of the coordination between the Food Access Network and the COAD, and we feel like it really demonstrates what the United Way and the COAD have been trying to build and utilizing these community existing community partners that are already doing the work together. So as we talk about, so first let's talk about those, what we consider 3 weeks. It was only 2 weeks of non-payment, but you may or may not be aware that many times SNAP benefits don't meet the full need anyway. So folks get toward the end of the month and they already need some support from pantries, which is why about 25% of the folks that our Food Access Network are serving already receive SNAP benefits. So we were talking about those folks needing additional food. And then in addition to that, in addition to the 11,000 unduplicated individuals our network serves in a month on average, another 10,000 people trying to serve them. So in those first 3 weeks, we don't have all the data in yet, but we're still collecting this and we'll plan to sort of put out a report. The Food Access Network partners distributed 25% more food, that's by pounds of food, and saw an increase of 15% of the number of households. And so I don't have the unique individual number is going to be really pertinent here as we look at that. And that is those 3 weeks in comparison to the same period of time last year. So that's like your best comparison number. So as we, the SNAP crisis in this iteration has ended, the payments have been made, but there are some after effects. There are two things. There are some after effects for folks who didn't get those benefits on time, and then there's also the sort of hidden crisis that we were never able to talk about, because right at the time that that was about to hit, we had this other thing pop up related to SNAP. So first, some of the ongoing challenges for folks who didn't get their SNAP benefits is, what do you do when you don't have money for food? You can go to a pantry, but not everybody can get there and it doesn't work out. And how folks manage their budgets is moving the money around to their various bills. And we know that typically food money goes toward rent. Like, that's what normally gets done. In this case, because there was no notice, because there was no opportunity to plan in advance and get some food and hold it, folks used their rent money. They used their utility money. And putting money on a SNAP card for buying food does not put the money back in the bank account to pay that utility bill. It doesn't put it back in the bank account to pay the rent bill and, you know, to not face eviction now that you're behind. And so, you know, that is something that we really don't have a good plan for how to address, except for one of the things that we can potentially foresee is that, as I said, and as we all know, the phrase rent eats first. So what we might see is these folks continuing to use pantries, even as they've gotten their food benefits, to further supplement those budgets, and so they can turn that money into their money for their bills. So that is one of the ongoing things we see. Let's talk about this other crisis that was already happening, which is the changes in eligibility guidelines that were happening starting November 1st, which was changing who was being required to work, and specifically our legal immigrant and refugee participants and staff. You know, in the terms of supporting refugees that come to our country, one of the things we commit to is supporting them when they come here with these types of supports. So to cut off food benefits for these folks, and now they will be heavily reliant on food pantries. So we were already expecting to see this change. And because we also had this other influx, I don't think we will fully understand what that looks like maybe for the next 6 months. But it is something that we're keeping an eye on and that we can just expect will be a continued increase.
Did I cover everything?
Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right. So Nikki mentioned how proud she is of the response. The COAD and the Food Access Network. I also want to acknowledge how proud I am of our community. Nikki mentioned 25% increase in pounds of food or 15% households. I think our food partners experienced maybe a similar increase in level of support. We have seen increased financial donations across the board, not just to the fund, but to individual pantries, food drives that are making it so maybe they can reserve those funds until after the holidays. There's always more support for those kinds of organizations in November and December and January, and then it gets to be a really hard time in the February, March, and April. So these things are starting to be able to pad that safety net that our community is going to continue needing. But I just want to, again, emphasize, one, how grateful we are that our community has showed up, and I'm very proud to live in Johnson County and see this sort of response, and two, that we need to continue it and keep folks kind of on top of. And I know it's difficult. We just had a housing presentation, and there's a housing crisis in it, and it feels like everything is a crisis, and in some ways it is. But I want to emphasize that seeing this action really gives us hope that we can locally come together. Our COAD is also a representation of that. Our community organizations, active in disaster, is the only support we have when there is a natural disaster that doesn't meet the qualifications for state or federal funding. And so just a closing remark is to encourage individuals to continue engaging in these efforts and aligning with this collaborative work that's already happening. And two, to just kind of remember who this is impacting and who is closest to those, and to take our guidance from those individuals and honor that expertise. Thank you. Do we have questions?
Just a quick one. I'm curious the geographic boundaries of the COAD and the Food Access Network, and if they're exactly the same, and also are our neighboring communities keeping up?
Yeah, so United Way is Johnson and Washington counties. However, our COAD is specifically Johnson County, as is the Food Access Network. Washington County has had a separate response that's more focused in the public health.
Yeah. Actually, the Food Access Network, while is largely funded locally, there are about 5 partners who see quite a number of folks from outside of our county, and we will continue to see that increase as those resources are unable to keep up.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for that correction. Yes, all of the agencies are here, but we, for instance, several serve rural communities right outside of Johnson County and into Washington. And they've actually seen an increase in visits from out-of-county participants, likely due to a little more robust response here.
And then second question, the government's funded through January 30th. That's right. So what lessons learned from this last year? Are there any lessons learned? I mean, it sounds like you guys are trying to build up a little bit of reserves, but how do you prepare for this really unpredictable government?
I don't have an answer for that, Josh. I think what we'll do from the food security standpoint specifically is just focus on our local community resilience. I think sometimes there's a little bit of a push and pull between a mutual aid type of support and then more established nonprofits. And I think that it's time to kind of move past some of that and acknowledge that both are necessary to truly meet the need. And just think about, you know, what is your goal? Are you trying to help your neighbors and your friends? Then kind of keep at that local level and do what you can. If you want to organize some more larger scale community support, please do try to engage with the collaborations and the systems that already exist. And this part's really important too. If there is an unmet need, to also do that. It's not to say that we're trying to ignore pockets of need. It's really important to know about those and figure out a way to meet them as a community.
Thanks.
Not really a question, just wanted to say thank you.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Right. I wanted to say thank you as well. Also, thank you so much to our city staff for being just so Johnny on the spot with all of the fundraising and the food drives and the messaging that y'all did. That was super effective. So thank you from the city manager down to everybody else. That was really cool to see. Also, just wanted to ask if I know that we're talking about there might be after effects to this, or we know there will be after effects to this, but and we might not know about them for six or for months on end. I suppose I was just wondering if maybe if there was a way that we could get some type of extra attention on things like utility shutoffs. Like, are we seeing an increase in things like that? Because like what everybody was saying, you know, if a lot of people, I mean, it's an impossible choice between rent, utilities, and food. But at the end of the day, food is, you know, you need that to survive. I guess I'm just interested in that data going forward. And I guess I would like for us to keep track of it.
A goal of the Food Access Network is to track these sorts of data points, and it's one of our collective data is one of the most powerful things we have in communicating the impact. So one of the things we'll be looking at, as you know, Community Crisis Services offers financial assistance, which includes utility type things, and then working with Johnson County General Assistance to see how much increase they've gotten in sort of requests. And so I think we have a good functional way of collecting that sort of thing and then reporting back as to what we're seeing.
Gotcha. Thank you.
Yeah, and just to add on what Nikki said, I don't believe at this point there's been, you know, a quantifiable increase in shutoffs and things like that, but definitely an increase from those partners that provide utility or rent assistance, an increase in requests. And for some of our housing partners, an increase in the percentage of non-payment at a certain point in the month. And thankfully those are those that wouldn't evict immediately, but hopefully we don't see an increase in evictions in the private market moving forward. I think to kind of echo one of the closing statements to Oliver's question, is we do need to come together around all of these issues as a whole. And just last week, there was a conversation brought together by one of our county supervisors to kind of see what that might look like. And my being involved in that meeting, my first response is, you know, let's find what's the appropriate venue for that, right? Who are the right people that need to be there? There's a new collective starting, the Johnson County Nonprofit Collective, which is open to any nonprofit in the area, and kind of that's a great convening point, and to ask the questions from those closest first before deciding on a response.
Thank you. Great. I'm going to call up Shannon at this time, and we only have like 3 minutes.
I can do this quickly.
All right.
Good afternoon, Mayor and Council. My name is Shannon McMahon. I'm Communications Coordinator for the city. In response to Community Crisis Services outreach regarding growing concerns of food insecurity in our community, The communications office introduced Neighbors Helping Neighbors Food Drive on Tuesday, November 4th, and our community has stepped up. We've seen strong public involvement and staff participation across city facilities, at grocery store partner events, and neighborhood park pop-ups. All donations support Community Crisis Services and Food Bank. Donation activity to date includes 3,200 pounds of food, which has been collected and delivered to the Community Crisis Services, $405 in unanticipated cash donations were received and will go directly to the same facility. We placed 10 donation boxes at separate city facilities throughout the community, providing convenient access points for residents and employees to contribute throughout the drive. Our grocery store events were held on Friday, November 14th at three locations, Westside Fairway and two Hy-Vee locations, North Dodge and Hy-Vee on First Avenue. These events themselves generated almost 2,300 pounds of donated items. Volunteer participation from staff and amazingly supportive community helped make this event possible. And then finally, we have neighborhood park events going on. As we speak, these events started on Monday night at Happy Hollow Park, are being held at James Allen McPherson Park tonight, and Weatherby Park on Wednesday from 4 to 6 p.m. This initiative wraps up November 21st, but we do want to say thank you to everyone for the partnerships, from our staff who stepped up. Our community is fantastic. We worked fast to put this together, and it's the biggest initiative that we've had since I've been here for 19 years. So anyway, thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for the report, and thanks again to everybody that was participating and to spread the word, and for the community members that came to meet this timely need. We're going to move on to item number 6, which is council updates on assigned boards, commissions, and committees.
Nada.
All right. We can consider ourselves adjourned.